Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. Every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Thanks for being here. Today, we're going to take a look at the impact of movies on our perceptions of reality. Specifically, how have movies prepared us for the apocalypse? To guide us through this cinematic exploration is my guest and veteran film critic, Robert Horton. In addition to hosting VOV's Sunday night show, Music in the Movies, Robert is a member of the National Society of Film Critics. He was the longtime film reviewer for the Seattle Weekly, the Everett Herald, and KUOW, and a regular contributor to Film Comment. His books include A Critical Study of Frankenstein. He has been a Fulbright specialist, a Smithsonian Journeys speaker, and an instructor at Seattle University and the Architectural Association in London. He spent two terms as a Humanities Washington speaker from 2010 to 2014, and he's going to do it again this year. There's much more to Robert's story, but I want to spend our time today asking him about movies and the apocalypse. In fact, he'll be doing it this presentation tonight on Scarecrow Video. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
Gosh, I'm kind of intimidated by that resume.
That's just a sign of how long I've been around. If you last long enough, you start to compile these things, I think.
You do. Well, before we get too deeply into the whole idea of movies and the apocalypse, tell us about Scarecrow Video.
Oh, well, Scarecrow who's presenting this program tonight is, it's the world's largest publicly accessible video archive.
Really?
There are some bigger archives at, L.A. and New York or whatever, but you can just go into Scarecrow and rent a movie, and it's pretty amazing. But I'm on the board of directors there, and I kind of nudged them. I said, could I have a title like Programmer Historian in Residence? And they said yes. And so for the last couple of years, I've been teaching what's now an online class. In fact, I'm doing one again in October on film noir that we're calling Scarecrow Academy. And so we do it on Saturday afternoons. People zoom in, and we get to talk about the movie that we watched that week, kind of like a movie club in a way.
Oh, that sounds great. Do we just go to scarecrow.org to get all the information and sign up?
Yeah, search for Scarecrow Academy if you have to, but that's how that goes. And so they are being good enough to also host tonight's Humanities Washington program that I'm doing. Tonight being, if you're listening to this live, as we are, it's Tuesday night, the 14th of September, but at 8 o'clock. But yeah, it's this new talk that I'm doing about apocalyptic movies.
Yeah, so let's go there. That is a really scary notion, the idea that movies have prepared us for the coming apocalypse. Which movies do you think most accurately predicted the impacts we're experiencing now with the climate crisis and the pandemic?
Yeah, this was the inspiration for thinking about this. I have to say, I've always really liked end of the world movies, which is a whole other thing. I sort of get into it during the talk, like, why would someone like that? But
yeah, I like them too.
Yeah, they're intriguing. But I thought, as we were going through this pandemic last year, I started thinking, in some ways, the movies have predicted something like this. Whether it was a virus-related thing or just, planets colliding or a comet coming to us or whatever. And they depicted all these ways of either people figured out a way to get together and work on the problem, or we turned against each other and there were riots in the streets and misinformation going out and people using demagoguery to gain their own power or whatever.
Wow.
And I thought, let's put these two things together and see what we might have learned if we'd been, paying attention to some of these films, however outlandish, some of them are. So I show some film clips and talk about some of the history of that. And then hopefully we get a discussion going, because that's really what it's all about.
Yeah.
And I hope people will relate some of their pandemic experiences to, some of the things that we've just watched on these movies or movies that they can remember from their childhood or, whatever it is.
So is there a movie you've selected that most effectively depicts the pandemic we're experiencing?
Well, we talk about all kinds of different movies, but there is that film from 2011 called Contagion.
Yes.
Steven Soderbergh directed it. It's got a kind of an all-star cast where you sit there thinking, I wonder who's going to die before the end of this with all these big stars in it. That's, nobody's safe, you know. And that movie really, I remember reading when the pandemic started that a lot of people were watching it online and, you know, suddenly it was spiking and it's... Uh-huh. And it is true that there's all these very interesting parallels. The disease in that movie is much more, it's more like Ebola, so it's more violent. But the government response and there's a character in it played by Jude Law, who's a kind of an influencer on the internet. And he's got this completely bogus cure that he's telling people. It's not a horse paste. I'll just cut to the chase. But it's something like that, where it has no effect whatsoever. But he's getting some money from somebody to say that it is, and so he goes out there. And so you watch some of these scenes, and you think, oh wow, it was completely predicted. You know, it was all laid out there. All of the flimflammery and the bogusness and everything, and then it rolled out in reality.
Was there a resolution that we could look toward at the end of Contagion?
Well, in that case, they did conquer it. So it was sort of a blueprint for what not to do.
And there we are following it.
I mean, yeah, that's the real ending of the movie. They may have resolved it in that film, but the actual ending turned out to be open-ended, and we didn't quite pick up the clues.
Uh-huh. So... what do these films say about human nature?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because you see certain scenes that are similar in film after film. Like I show some movies that are about atomic nuclear after effects or climate change or whatever it is. And yet through each of them, there's often a discussion about what do, you know, if it's at the highest reaches of government, what do we tell the people? How much do we tell them? They'll panic if we tell them too much. But we'll make sure that we're on the giant spaceship that we're constructing that gets to leave the planet, you know, before we collide with the other one. So there, it brings up things like that, like how do you manage, you know, public opinion and public information? There's also this interesting thread that goes through a lot of them, which is that there's, in some of these movies, the apocalypse is just about to happen, and then in some of them, it's happened, and you're trying to figure out, you know, what the lessons are. And in a lot of them, there's this idea, the characters will get together and say, well, we've got to rebuild, and this time, it's going to be right. We're going to get it right. We're going to treat each other well. We're going to, you know, do these things in brotherhood and sisterhood and so on. So a lot of them have a kind of optimistic quality, even though they've just shown you, you know, the destruction of the entire globe or whatever, or the decimation of the population. But there is often this message of, look what could have happened if we don't work together, if we don't listen to each other, if we don't talk to each other. And therefore, when we do this again, and when the lights go up after this movie is ended, that's what we have to start doing. We start talking to each other. And one thing I point out that I've always found kind of funny, even as a kid watching these on, you know, Nightmare Theater on Friday nights, is that there's a strain of these movies that where the end credit comes up, and instead of saying the end, it says the end ? Or the beginning ? You know, it's there. That's a whole subgenre, I think, of film that, but in its own funny way, it is saying, well, it's up to us now. You know, you've seen the worst. What are you going to do now?
So the definition in these movies of doing it better is brotherhood and sisterhood and cooperation and collaboration. How does that compare to what we're going through now?
If this were a test, I believe we are flunking, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I guess it's been 100 years since the last giant pandemic, and maybe that's too long to go to remember the lessons or something, because we certainly did not take them from reality, let alone the movies. I think it's uncanny, you know, that you know, people who make films or novelists or other kinds of storytellers, I suppose, were warning us this whole time, mm-hmm. and telling us, here's the nightmare scenario. Here's the thing that you don't want to do. But, you know, humankind, we tend to step in the same traps that we've stepped in before. Don't want to sound too discouraging.
Maybe it means we have a better opinion of ourselves than is actually true, or a better image of human nature than is actually true. Yeah. The movie that comes to my mind that has a different kind of ending is A Boy and His Dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where, for those of you who are listeners, maybe Robert, you can describe the theme of that film. It's a post-apocalyptic film.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's almost like Mad Max, you know, on an even lower budget or something. And yeah, that you know, there was that time like in the 70s when you could have a much more bleak ending to things and a conclusion, and much more cynicism about how things are going. That's true. Yeah, and in, you know, even in some of these films that I'm talking about where they have this kind of optimistic dialogue going on, that might happen halfway through the movie, and then the ending might not go so well for everybody either. So you're getting the warnings, even when they turn out badly. You have to have been paying attention, I suppose, through the entire film,
as to what the trajectory was of human nature and how they responded.
Yeah, and to get a little bit of hope in the end. But I suppose, I mean, your point about, you know, do we think too highly of ourselves, overestimate ourselves? Mm-hmm. I think that is a perennial truth, yes, in humankind. You know, what else I've been watching lately I've been kind of going through a bunch of old Twilight Zone episodes, because I do reference one about a bomb shelter in the talk. And it is interesting how that idea of assessing mankind for what we've got, you know, like, hey, here are some good qualities. On the other hand, boy, do we mess it up on a regular basis. And you always see that in the Twilight Zone. It amazes me that we've had these messages for all these decades, you know, in some ways from popular culture. Mm-hmm. And that is not necessarily popular culture's job, but, you know, it's nice sometimes if there is something thoughtful going on. And yeah, we managed to fumble it.
Art imitates life. A couple things you mentioned piqued my interest. And one is, you sort of alluded to the notion that the 70s was a more cynical time than now. Can you elaborate on that?
I'm thinking about the movies in particular, but there was sort of that era of where the post 60s hangover was maybe going a little bit sour in the 70s, and movies had a tendency, they were kind of unleashed for a while there, where they could have downbeat endings and things that reminded you how bad things could get. And you know you think of the guys in Easy Rider going on their last drive there in the final sequence, and it's like, no, it's not going to work out for you.
Yeah.
Or the end of Chinatown, or where it's like, oh, how much worse could things get? Watch this.
Or Soylent Green.
Soylent Green. Yeah, that's a good one. And well, Planet of the Apes. That's a film that I mentioned in this apocalyptic talk. There was this period where movies could really almost consistently leave you with a rather sobering, let's say, ending, in contrast to so many other, you know, the history of film before that had been quite a few happy endings. Let's put it that way.
Well, it seems to me too that a lot of, or maybe all of, these films about apocalyptic events are about saving the human race, but they don't really say much about, other than Planet of the Apes, saving the rest of the species on the planet. And as we look at climate crisis, it seems to me it's time for us to think about how saving the others might save us too. Do you know of any films that actually talk about, gosh, let's save the whole planet?
Mm. Yeah.
Anybody?
It certainly is all connected, ecologically speaking.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, you know, there's a couple of films that are especially this kind of let's build a spacecraft so that we can get to the nearest habitable planet. And they do make a thing of having a Noah's Ark type of deal, you know, where they've like one of them is When Worlds Collide, which is one of those great 50s sci-fi films, where they do make a point of saying, yes, we've got to take these certain amount of animals and a certain plant cultures or whatever it is. But hey, I mean, mostly we're concerned with ourselves here on this planet. Let's face it, we're a bit self-centered in that.
We are.
Yeah.
You're listening to Real Talk, and we're talking with film critic and educator Robert Horton, who is also the host of Music and the Movies here on The Voice of Vashon. And he's going to be making a presentation on Scarecrow Video tonight about how the movies have prepared us, if you will, for the apocalypse. I wonder, one of the other things that piqued my interest when we talk about human nature and how that's depicted in these apocalyptic films, it seems like it says a lot about power and how corrupting power is. Because you mentioned the leaders are always ready to put themselves in the spaceship.
Yes, or the underground tunnels, you know, that are going to be built.
Right, yeah.
You think of that ending of Dr. Strangelove where they're all sitting around the war room and they say, well, you know, we've got these tunnels created and it's going to have to be us that goes into them for the next 100 years and so on. Yeah, that's an interesting thing, isn't it, about, you know, science fiction is that it does, it often allows for a critique of the system, whatever you might mean by that, or the establishment, in a way that doesn't always come into the the genre kind of allows you to get into that in a way that many sort of just mainstream non-genre films don't ever bother to do that. So I kind of like that about this idea. And it is a kind of a through line in a lot of these films that people are looking to the government for the answers, and invariably there's so much chicanery going on that you know, unless Morgan Freeman is the president, which
yes,
he is
right.
in at least one or two of these things,
and
then he's going to do the right thing, and he's not going to put himself in the capsule. He's going to take it, you know.
That's right. Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford probably would do the right thing.
Yes,
yeah, when the
right.
comet hits.
So yeah, that brings me to the notion of movies and how they affect our perception of reality in general. And the first genre that comes to mind about that is romantic comedies. What do you have to say about the impact of romantic comedies on our perception of relationships?
Wow. I would say, you know, take them as romantic comedies and not as a blueprint, maybe. No, I think you're probably getting to something true there about expectations, perhaps. And one of the things that I always thought was weird, I mean, of course, a lot of people have observed the dangers of the kind of knight in shining armor syndrome, Prince Charming sort of thing. One of the things I always kind of thought was weird about romantic comedies was that they seem to encourage persistence, usually on the part of the male character in the formula, in a way that starts to look like harassment at a certain point. It's like, but like, this is supposed to be charming and funny. Why doesn't that guy just give up?
But he's stalking her.
Yeah, this is crossed over into stalking now. Yeah,
yeah. Right.
That's something that has not worn well, I guess, in the history of romantic comedy.
Well, and I think too about the evolution of characters in film over time, and the first one that comes to my mind over the last 50 years, the hero who has moved from that sort of unidimensional hero to the more complex anti-hero. What have you seen? What have you noticed about that in the evolution of those characters?
Well, it's an interesting topic. I mean, one of the things, you know, it was really in the 60s and 70s that the movies started embracing that kind of anti-hero thing in a more complex way. I don't know. I don't know about you, but in many ways, especially in big Hollywood movies, we've kind of gone back to the less complex hero in recent, you know, last couple of decades. I find you kind of have to go toward independent films, I suppose, or something to start to explore more complicated heroes and heroines who have flaws. And then when you get to one, you know, what just popped into my mind actually is that movie Promising Young Woman that came out last year.
Yes.
Which has an extremely difficult main character who's damaged and traumatized and who doesn't do things that are smart always, although she's very smart. And then has an ending that's very disturbing and is not what the audience wants to have happen, but is complicated. You have to think about it and think through it and so on. And that seemed to me a rarity, actually, in recent film, that you would have, that because Hollywood has to have heroes that are likable and that you're going to root for. And if you start to get into too many gray areas, it's like, no, we're not spending $100 million on a movie where the audience isn't just rooting for this guy.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that particularly big Hollywood movies have to make a lot of their money internationally? In other words, that cultural complexity and nuance doesn't necessarily translate to those international audiences.
Well, that is an interesting question. And there has been a lot of talk about that. I would say the short answer is yes. I think it does go into that. And that was responsible. People started talking about that in the 80s when stars like Schwarzenegger and Stallone became very, very big worldwide. And right. It was almost a joke. It's like the fewer words they say, the better it will play in China and Russia and, you know, across the entire globe. And then it wasn't a joke anymore because, in fact, that's how people were making movies with a thought toward that. That sort of ebbed a little bit, but now we're in the superhero era. And so a lot of those movies are incredibly well made, and yet everything is very clean. Everything is, all the emotions are laid out for you in a very clear way, and the relationships of the characters, and it's mostly action. So I think that's part of the it's the appeal of those films, but it's also why those movies are getting made in the way that they're getting made.
And it makes me wonder a couple things. One is, does that reflect a societal hope for courage, for courageous leaders? And two, have we moved our complex characters into the golden age of television? There's so much on cable TV and on streaming platforms, series particularly, that can take the time to develop a character. What do you have to say about
that? I would agree 100% with that. And I don't, you know, both with this kind of time factor, and there's something about the intimacy of the television there that maybe allows you to take that time to be with people who are conflicted and or traumatized or make bad decisions sometimes. And the movies are so expensive to make and to distribute that the studios and the other people who make them they don't have time for that. They don't want those complicating things to go on. Unless you start to get down into the realm of the shorthand word would be indie cinema or indie movies or whatever, and you can start to play around with that stuff because you're aiming for showing your stuff at film festivals and maybe getting some awards attention that will make sure you get your money back, and you can attract a really good actor who's starved to make something that's complex, you know, and will cut his or her salary in order to do that. I think it's inescapable, the conclusion that you're describing there, that a lot of that stuff is fleeing to television, especially the long form kind of television.
Well, yeah. And it makes me wonder too, there are indie movies, if you will, showing up on the big platforms like Netflix and Prime and Hulu. And so what does that say about the future of the movie business in general? Where is it going?
This is one of those, I think they're calling them flex points now or something like that. And it's because we're in the middle of a pandemic that every single thing about movie distribution is being questioned, how we see movies. And absolutely no one, the highest paid person at Warner Brothers or Universal or Disney doesn't know any more than the two of us sitting here in the studio know. It's a moment of panic for a lot of people in the business, and no one knows. You know, we've had a slate of big giant movies that were released to Warner Brothers through HBO Max. And the ostensible reason was the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But the big question is that the future? Is that the way everything's going to be? You'll try to open a movie on 2,000 theater screens at the same time that it opens in your living room? Is that viable in any way? And what does that do? And there's 1,000 questions. I certainly don't know the answers, but I do have this, I have the fundamental belief that people want to go and be with other people. And you go into a big room and the lights go down, mm-hmm. and you're all laughing at the same time and shouting at the same time. And home video was supposed to end that back in the 80s, and it did not.
Right.
There were all kinds of signs of doom going on back then, and people still wanted to go into that dark room and hang out and have this experience.
Yeah, because you can be immersed in it that way.
Yep, completely.
You really get lost in the story.
Yep. You can't stop it by clicking a button, and right. your phone isn't going off, except, of course, it is in movie theaters these days.
But yeah, people that's a whole need other. To learn now that they're not at home.
Yeah. That's
when
that's
they're in a movie
etiquette.
Theater.
That's a whole other topic we could go to town on. Yes.
So I'm seeing some experiments with film being released both online and in theaters, and it seems to be, particularly with the fall releases this year, because maybe more people are vaccinated, or of course we thought we had it licked, and that's yeah. probably when all these movies were scheduled for theater release. Have you seen any that that thrived on that experiment?
It's probably too early to tell, but so far the consensus is that it has probably hurt some of the bigger films, like Black Widow, which was a big Marvel. Probably would have had bigger numbers if it hadn't, you know, opened on the small screen the same time that it opened the big screen. Mm. There's all these big ones hanging in the balance, like the new James Bond movie, which somehow has become like the one movie that everybody's, okay, are they going to move it again to a different date? Is it going to stay on this date and still be affected by the pandemic? How soon will it be on TV? And then there's a new adaptation of Dune, this science fiction classic that's mm-hmm. got the same questions hanging around it. First, it was going to open on HBO Max, I think, and theaters. Now they're backing away from that because, you know, I mean, the filmmakers are upset too because they want the movie to be on the big screen.
Sure.
And there's also a financial thing that goes on with them having in contracts that were made up 3 years ago that says, hey, here's your cut of the gross from the theater release, which is going to be, of course, months before it shows up on cable TV. And people who signed those contracts, who are, you know, giant stars, are saying, I'm not getting the $50 million I would have gotten for my percentage. And that's why Scarlett Johansson recently sued Disney.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Which is really biting the hand that feeds everyone, I guess.
But interesting turn of events.
It's going to be a very interesting case, yeah. Uh-huh. But that just shows you how many levels are at play at this uncertain time. There's so many pieces of this bizarre, you know, house of cards that nobody's done this in quite this way before.
Yeah, kind of. I think there may be a few parallels between that and the music industry and what happened with that and technology, but the film industry is influenced by so much more than technology, by the pandemic, by everything that's going on socially. And right. we have run out of time. I'm really sorry.
You knew. We said this is the end. The apocalypse is near. So if you're saying we've run out of time, I guess it's right.
Robert Horton, I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Nice talking to you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you all for listening. So happy that you took a few moments of your time to spend with me here on Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here every Tuesday at lunchtime and at your convenience at voiceofashon.org.